All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the last Quantinformation seminar for this calendar year, for which we have Alex May from the University of British Columbia talking about quantum tasks in holography. Please take it away, Alex.
Great. Yeah. So I'd just like to start by saying thanks for the invitation to speak. It's a great opportunity. So what I'm going to be talking about today is a subject that I'm calling quantum tasks in holography. And this is based on work appearing in two papers, the first by myself from early last year, and the second from late last year, which was done in collaboration with John Soros and Jeff Pennington. I will comment that I think the clearest presentation of these ideas is in the second reference, so I'd point you there if you're going to follow up. And I think I can get started. Okay, so I want to start out by telling you, or maybe reminding you, that nowadays quantum information theory plays a significant role in the understanding of quantum gravity. And this is played out most concretely in the context of what's called the ADS-CFT correspondence. So I will talk a lot about ADS-CFT today. I won't assume any knowledge though, so I will hopefully explain that, and do ask me questions if I'm unclear. Okay, so there's this connection between quantum information and quantum gravity, but something about it that I want to highlight is that the sort of quantum information theory that we've thought about in that context is not one that has thought very hard about how information can and cannot be processed in a uniquely space-time setting. And something I want to emphasize, or I think maybe the main takeaway from the talk today, is that by thinking about quantum information processing in a space-time context, will be led to new insights in quantum gravity. And also, I'll claim that the converse also happens, that quantum gravity can give us some insights into information theory in this space-time setting. Okay. So here's a outline for the talk today. I'm going to first of all recall a framework for thinking about how quantum information can be processed in space-time. And this will bring me to an idea called the relativistic quantum tasks. Okay. And then second, I'll discuss how we can apply quantum tasks to thinking about ADS-CFT and the sort of results that we can obtain by doing so. Okay. And then finally, I'll discuss what ADS-CFT I think is telling us about quantum tasks. And in particular, I'll argue that it tells us that something called quantum non-local computation can be performed more efficiently than is currently understood in the quantum information literature. Okay. So let me get started. So I'll first of all tell you about these relativistic quantum tasks. Okay, so what is a quantum task? Well, it's just a quantum computation, but one with a little bit of added structure in that the inputs and outputs to the computation will occur at designated locations in space-time. Okay, to talk about these, it's useful to have some operational language. So we're gonna introduce two agencies, Alice and Bob, and Alice will be the person who receives inputs and processes the information in some way and then produces outputs. And Bob will be the person who gives Alice her inputs and then verifies her outputs are what they are supposed to be. Okay, just a comment here is that this sort of framework I'm gonna describe of quantum tasks was first described by Adrian Kent back in 2012 in a paper that's influenced me quite a lot. And many of you may know Adrian, he's associated with Perimeter. Okay. Okay, so to start fleshing this out a bit, let me give you a very simple example of a quantum task. So here I'm in 1+1 dimensional Minkowski space. So time runs upward here and the spatial direction is horizontal. And then in this task, there will be one input location or input point where Bob will give to Alice some quantum system A. And then Alice's task, or what she's supposed to do, is to return that system at some other location, R1. Okay. And then Bob will check that it is what it's supposed to be. Okay. So given any example of a task such as this one, we can ask various questions about it. So maybe the simplest question we can ask is just, with what probability can you actually complete the task? So that's just, you know, some number, success probability for the task T. And something about that I want to highlight is that success probability depends not just on what inputs and outputs we specify, but also on the locations in space-time of those inputs and outputs. Okay, so in this example, I've put R1 in the future of C1, so it's possible to travel from C1 to R1. And that will mean that there is a simple strategy with a high success probability where Alice just moves A along some causal curve from C to R. Okay. On the other hand, if I had put R1 down here, outside the future light cone of C1, then the success probability would be small. Okay. So that's the most basic kind of question. Maybe a more detailed question is, if we specify something about the success probability, right? So if I say that it has to be bigger than some number alpha, I can ask, what does that tell me about the resources that must be necessary to complete the task with that probability? So an example of a resource here in this context would be something like shared entanglement, but I should be careful to specify between which locations in space-time the entanglement is shared. Okay, good. Okay, so to give you a bit of a better idea of what these tasks are, I'll just give you like a richer example with a bit more detail. So this will be an example of what's called a summoning task. This is just one class of tasks that's been thought about in some detail, introduced again by Kent back in 2011, and studied by various other people, including myself and Patrick and Kafir, who's here today, I think. So this more complicated task has now two inputs, C1 and C2, as well as two outputs, R1 and R2. And I've arranged these in a particular way in now two plus one dimensional Minkowski space. So there's two spatial directions, right? This is spatial and this is spatial. And then a time direction running upward. And I've arranged them such that there's particular causal connections between the points. In particular, it's possible to travel from C1 to R1 and from C1 to R2, as well as from C2 to R2 and from C2 to R1. Okay. On the other hand, I've been careful to place these points such that there does not exist any location P such that P is in the past of R1 and R2, as well as in the future of C1 and C2. Okay. So you can never sort of meet in the middle like this. Okay, so that's the causal features of the setup here. And then in terms of the task that Alice has to do, what I'll specify is that at C1, Alice is gonna receive the unknown quantum state psi. And then at C2, she'll receive a classical bit, B, which will take on the values 1 or 2. And then what she has to do is to return psi to the output labeled by B. So for instance, if B was 1, she'll return psi, or she's supposed to return psi to R1. Okay. So that's the task. Now we can think about strategies for doing this and success probabilities. So here's the sort of naive strategy. Alice holds psi at C1. She knows it needs to get to either R1 or R2. She can try and just send it to the correct location. Now, of course, this doesn't work very well because the information B about where psi is supposed to go is not available near C1, where psi is. And so she's forced to guess and send it to either R1 or R2. And so she'll only succeed with probability 1/2. Okay. Now, that's not the only strategy available though. She can use a more clever strategy, in particular using quantum teleportation. And so the way that works is she now shares an EPR pair in advance such that it'll be distributed between C1 and C2. Okay. And then when she receives psi, right away she measures psi and one end of the EPR pair in the Bell basis, gets some classical measurement outcome J. Okay. And then she's sort of partly solved her problem here because J is classical. And so she can choose to send it to both locations, right? So she'll send J to both R1 and R2. Okay. Now, in the meantime, after she's made that measurement, this particle over here, the other end of the EPR pair, will be in the state PJ psi, where P is some poly labeled by J. And this is a quantum system. So she's forced to choose where to send that. But now, fortunately, this quantum system, PJ psi, is located in the same place as B. And so she can use B to route the quantum part to the appropriate place. So if B is, say, 1, she can send it up here. So she gets PJ psi. And then she can undo the poly and output psi correctly. Okay. So the reason I want to go through, I've gone through this in some detail, is that I think that this quantum task captures a sort of interesting and space-time specific aspect of the quantum teleportation protocol. So it solves for you this sort of coordination problem where Alice didn't know where to send psi, and does it in a sort of interesting way where you turn the information here into something classical and then you're sort of making use of B immediately, even though it's outside your light cone somehow. Okay, so the larger point there is that these quantum tasks sort of capture aspects of quantum information that are unique or specific to this space-time context. Okay. Also comment that this kind of observation is not new or unique to what I'm talking about here. A very similar observation actually appears in the original paper on quantum teleportation, the famous teleporting in unknown quantum state using dual EPR and classical channels. Okay, good. Okay, so that's so much for tasks. Are there questions at this point about that part? Pause for a sec. Okay, I'll take that as a no. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about how we can use this sort of reasoning about quantum tasks to tell us something about ADS-CFT and about quantum gravity. Okay, so I don't want to assume any knowledge of ADS-CFT, so I'll just say a few things about it. Let me also say that, you know, I often give talks to high energy theorists, and so I might assume some language that that they might know that you might not, so please just stop me if I do so. Okay, so what is ADS-CFT? Well, it's a duality or the statement of equivalence of two apparently different physical theories. Okay, and so the two theories are, on the one hand, quantum gravity in what's called in a specific kind of spacetime called an asymptotically ADS spacetime. And then on the other side of the duality, we have a conformal field theory, which lives on the boundary of that ADS spacetime. So you can think of, I've essentially unrolled, if this cylinder is like some soup can, I've just unrolled the label of the soup can and laid it out here, and that's my boundary geometry. Maybe a little bit more formally, what you should think about is in this ADS space, time is running upwards here, and a constant time slice is one of these disks, okay? This disk is actually infinite in spatial extent, but I've just chosen coordinates so that I can draw it as a finite disk. And so every point in the CFT, I should really think of as associated with a direction I can shoot a light ray out from the bulk out to infinity. And so every direction into infinity I can go becomes some point in this manifold, which is then the manifold on which I'm defining my conformal field theory. Okay, so a couple of comments sort of comparing the two sides of this duality or relating the two sides of this duality. The first is that on the ADS side, we have dynamical gravity. Okay, so we should think of some metric there, which is coupled to matter in some way. Okay, so the geometry can change. Whereas in contrast, in the CFT, the geometry is just fixed. So we can think of, say, a fixed flat space metric there. Okay. The next comment is that on the ADS side of this duality, we have D plus one dimensions. Okay. Whereas on the CFT side, we have only D dimensions. Okay. Now, of course, that's, you know, surprising and not obvious that a lower dimensional theory can fully describe this higher dimensional one. This is why I keep using this word holography. It's a bit mysterious and magical, but I'll just tell you that is indeed the case. This CFT in lower dimensions can fully describe the higher dimensional setting. Okay. Finally, I want to say that, or just point out that both sides of this duality include quantum fields. Okay, so that's just to say that it makes sense to sort of think about quantum information on both sides, right? So in the ADS side, I could think about, you know, qubits sitting in the bulk somewhere. And on the CFT side, I can think about, you know, quantum information that's stored in some space-time regions in the CFT. Okay, so we can sort of do information theory on both sides. Okay, good. Okay, so now I want to talk about how I want to think about quantum tasks in this context. And in particular, I'm going to sort of use quantum tasks to motivate one way of thinking about this equivalence of two theories. So what I'll say is, given a theory, either the ADS side or the CFT side, I'm going to associate with that theory a big giant list of all the tasks that I could define there. Okay. And then for each task, there's some associated success probability. Okay. And then the way that I'm going to understand this equivalence of theories, this duality, is I'm going to say that there should be some way to match up tasks on the two sides. So there should be a way to think of the same task in the ADS side as on, and then some corresponding identified task in the CFT side. And then because of the equivalence of the theories, they should have the same success probability. Okay. So I'm thinking of this equivalence of theories as basically an identification of these big lists of tasks that capture some information about the theory. Okay. Okay. So to make that a bit more precise, I need to tell you how I want to identify tasks across the duality, right? So what do I mean by the same task in ADS as a task in the CFT? And the one thing I have to tell you there is to restrict my attention on the ADS side to tasks T that have inputs and outputs at infinity. Okay, so I've drawn a input point here and an output point here. And then the way we should think about this is, you know, this R1 isn't really a point in space-time, but it's the instruction that you should send your output along some light ray in a particular direction. And then correspondingly, this is the statement that the system A will come in to the bulk along some light ray in some particular direction. Okay. And then it's clear that I should then identify, you know, this point here, or in other words, this light ray here was some point in the conformal field theory or in the boundary. And that lets me identify precisely what I mean by the same task in ADS and in the CFT. Okay. Good. Okay. So that's most of what I need to tell you about ADS CFT. Now I can get to applying these ideas from quantum tasks to this setting.
Alex, sorry, can I ask a question?
Yes, please do.
Can you go back two slides maybe to where you have the duality and the...
Sorry, mate. There we go.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So when you say that given a duality, you should have for each task, you should find some task in the dual theory such that these two success probabilities are the same. You're also assuming that somehow for every figure of merit in one on one side of the duality, there's going to be a quantity on the other side that somehow tells you the same thing, right? Is that?
I mean, I guess I'm assuming that on both sides we can make sense of what I mean by this success probability, right? So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe the thing to say there, right, is that the degrees of freedom. Sorry, my tablet isn't wanting to change slides very easily. But so on the two sides, right? The degrees of freedom can look very different. But I'm going to think about these tasks just at the level of quantum information. So it's clear that I can think about sort of the same qubit in recorded into two different sets of degrees of freedom. And then you're going to be, you know, at the end doing some measurement to check that your outputs are what they're supposed to be. And repeating this is going to give you some success probability. And so I think, yeah, generically in any theory, I should be able to define what I mean by this success probability.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, good. Okay, yeah. So I'm going to tell you about the one result that we came to by thinking this way. This was proven in this paper with John and Jeff. Okay, so to state it, I need to tell you, I guess, about one more thing in ADS CFT, or at least to give you the context for it, I need to tell you about this. So there's a very famous result in ADS CFT, which is called the Ryu-Taganaki formula. And the way it works is if I look at my ADS space, I pick some time slice here. I'll draw that time slice over here. And then I'm going to pick some subregion of the boundary. Okay. So that'll be this region I've labeled V. That's some subregion in the CFT, and I can associate with that a reduced density matrix, call it rho. In the CFT, I can use that density matrix to go and calculate the von Neumann entropy associated with that subregion. Okay. So that's a quantity and a number that I can calculate in the CFT. And then because these theories are equivalent, there should be some prescription for calculating that from the ADS side of this picture. And the Ryu-Taganaki formula tells you how to do that. Okay. So, and what it tells you is you should look at this, this boundary region V and consider all of the surfaces that enclose V. So these would be examples. Look for the minimal such surface, find its area, and then divide that by 4g Newton, okay? And that, at least to leading order, calculates for you this this entropy, okay? Now, I say to leading order because there's a order one correction here, where this series is in powers of g Newton. So this term is leading because it's in 1 over g Newton, and I work in a setting where g Newton is very small. And then this is subleading because it's g Newton to the zero. Okay, good. So given the Ryu-Taganaki formula, I can calculate other quantities. So the mutual information, of course, is just this linear combination of entropies. So I can use these surfaces to calculate it. And then the observation I want to make for you there is just that if we are, say, in this setting at the bottom, where the minimal surface enclosing the union of V1 and V2 is just itself the union of the minimal surface enclosing V1 with the minimal surface enclosing V2, right? So the minimal surfaces sit this way. Then the mutual information is order one. Just because the area terms here match with the area term here and they all cancel out. We're just left with that order one part. And then on the other hand, if the minimal surface enclosing V1 union V2, right, takes on this alternative configuration, sits this way, right? So these two surfaces still enclose the union, but they look different than this. Then there's actually a 1 over g Newton term in the mutual information. So in this case, the mutual information is large. Okay. Okay, good. So that's background, and now I can state the theorem for you. So here's the theorem. I have my ADS space. I pick 4 points on the boundary. Okay, so in this case, C1, C2, R1, and R2. And then I go and check if it's possible to meet in the middle between those 4 points. Okay, so if it's possible to travel from C1 into some point P, from C2 to that point, and then out again from that point to both R1 and R2. Okay, so I check if that's possible. And then if it is, the theorem concludes for me that 2 regions on the boundary will have a large mutual information. In particular, it'll be these regions V1 and V2. And them having a large mutual information, I can also state as their minimal surfaces sitting this way. Okay. On the other hand, if my 4 points don't meet in the middle like that, so by the time I get in from C1 and C2, I'm too late to get out to R1 and R2, then the theorem actually concludes nothing. And in particular, the minimal surfaces may sit the other way, and you may have a small mutual information. Okay. To make that a little bit more precise, I'll give you the definitions of these regions V1 and V2. So they're given here. Let me clean up this picture actually. Okay, so the way that V1 and V2, let's say V1 is defined is as the future of C1. So there's some light rays coming out like this. And then we intersect that with the past of R1. So there's a light ray coming here. And then the past of R2. Oops. Oh, doesn't want to, oh, there we go. Okay. There's a light ray coming here. And then those together define this region I've drawn in gray here. Okay. So that's V1, and then V2 is defined analogously, but with the point, the future of the point C2. Okay. Are there questions just about the statement of that theorem? I'm going to explain why it's true in a moment, but maybe just about what it is.
Hi, Alex. When you say you can walk to P, you mean there's a light cone structure in the bulk and yeah. You're walking, I see.
Yeah, that's right. So, sorry, I guess I didn't say that, but in words, you can describe it the way I described it, of it's possible to meet in the middle. If you want to think about light cones, then the statement is that this region I've defined down here is not empty. Right, so there, the intersection of the future of C1, future of C2, and past of R1 and past of R2 is not empty. Yeah. Okay.
Can I just ask a naive question? So does the dimensionality of ADS matter? Does it matter if it's ADS3 or more than ADS3?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The theorem is always true, as I've stated it, in whatever dimensions you're in, but it can be trivial, and often in higher dimensions it will be trivial. So what can happen is if so the statement that this scattering region being non-empty implies these surfaces or these regions have a lot of entanglement, this is true, but what can happen is that sometimes for certain configurations of R1, R2, C1, C2, V1 and V2 just intersect. And in that case, the statement's just trivial because, you know, you can think of the statement as the minimal surfaces will sit this way and they'll be connected. But if V1 and V2 overlap, then the minimal surface will always be this and they'll always be connected. And so it's sort of vacuous to say that they're held. There are situations in higher dimensions where it's not trivial, but for what's called global ADS 2+1, 3+1, it's actually always trivial. So in the case we might care about the most in higher dimensions, it's always trivial, but there are settings where it's not. Yeah, understanding this, I think there may be generalizations of this that apply in a more interesting way to higher dimensions. But maybe I can speak to that towards the end of the talk.
Yeah, there was this work, for example, by Giboyedov and Maldasen and Simon Staffens about this bulk point, right?
Yeah, that's right. So the geometry here is the same, and then the solution may also be the same. So they found that, you know, their statement would be in the boundary, you always get 2-2 scattering when you get bulk, when you get 2-2 scattering in the bulk as soon as you're in 3+1 dimensions.
Yes.
And then their solution was to instead think about 2-3 scattering, in which case the bulk situation is really qualitatively different than the boundary. You won't get 2-3 scattering on the boundary. And so the solution here may also be to think about settings with 2 inputs and 3 outputs. Uh-huh. But I haven't fully understood that yet.
Yes. So for EDS-5, it will be 2-4, right?
I think so, yeah. I think it's D-1.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So that's the theorem. Now let me discuss how you can argue for this theorem from this perspective of quantum tasks. Okay, so we're going to think about a particular quantum task, which I'll call the B84 task. And it has 2 inputs and 2 outputs. The first input is a bit, which is either 0 or 1. And the second input is a qubit in one of these states where H is the Hadamard and B is a bit, right? So for Q equals 0, this is either 0 or 1. Or Q equals 1, this is plus or minus. Okay. And then Alice's goal at the end is to output B at both output points. Okay, so that's the task. Now what I'm gonna do is think about that in the bulk perspective. Sorry, when I say bulk, I mean the ADS perspective, the higher dimensional perspective. So we'll first of all think about it in the ADS perspective, and then in the CFT perspective. And then by comparing the two, we'll arrive at this theorem that I just described. Okay. So let's think about this in the bulk. I said that in the bulk, we should always put our inputs and outputs off at infinity. So let's do that. So here's C1, C2, R1, R2. We have those inputs and outputs as I described. And then following the conditions of the theorem, I'm going to assume that this scattering region is not empty. So these points meet up in the bulk. Okay. Now, that region being non-empty is interesting from the perspective of tasks, because it means that there's a simple strategy for completing this task, right? And this simple strategy is the one I've illustrated schematically here. You just take Q and your qubit into the middle, do HQ. Now you're just in the computational basis, measure, find out B, and send B out to both locations, right? So this strategy always succeeds. So we have a success probability of 1. Okay. Next, I will think about this in the boundary perspective. So we've identified those 4 points with boundary points. So here's C1, C2, R1, R2. We have the same inputs and require the same outputs, just like before. But what's changed now is the geometry in which this task is happening, right? And in particular, what can happen is that in the boundary, you can just have an empty scattering region, even while the bulk scattering region is not empty. So you can see that here, because if you try and meet up from C1 and C2 and then get out to R1 and R2, well, you can only get out to R1 if you go here. On the other hand, you can meet up between C1 and C2 over here, but then only get out to R2, right? And so there's no point in the middle. Okay, so that limits the way this task can be completed in the boundary. In particular, it means that you can't use this sort of local strategy that I described before, where you just do everything in the middle point, right? You're not allowed to do anything here. Instead, you do the next best thing, which involves doing operations near C1 and near C2, and then near R1 and near R2. So in particular, you can do some quantum operation in here, which is in the future of C1 and the past of R1 and past of R2. So this non-local strategy that I've illustrated schematically, you should think of in the space-time picture by identifying this region here with this diamond here, right? Because this diamond, as I was describing it earlier, is the future of C1 and past of R1 and R2, which is exactly what this point in the schematic diagram is. Okay, so in the boundary, we are forced to use this non-local strategy. Okay, now let's compare these two perspectives. So first of all, recall that in the bulk, we had a scattering region, which meant that the success probability was 1. But then I claimed that, you know, because these theories are equivalent, that bulk success probability should equal the boundary success probability, right? And so that tells me that the boundary success probability is 1. Okay, but now I can use some results about these quantum tasks, which tell me that for the success probability in the boundary here to be 1, I actually need an EPR pair shared between V1 and V2. Okay, without that, your success probability is bounded above, and you know, this is something that you can find in you know, papers on quantum cryptography and things like that. Okay. So the take home is that for this success probability to be 1, which we know it is, V1 and V2 need to be entangled. Okay. Now, I've only argued for, you know, the presence of one EPR pair here, but you can make this more quantitative. And in particular, argue that you need to have a mutual information of order 1 over G Newton. And that leads us back to this theorem that I introduced. Because, you know, what is this theorem saying? It's saying that when there's a scattering region, which means the task can happen in the bulk, it has to happen in the boundary, which, you know, we argued requires entanglement between these two regions here. Okay, and that's indeed what the theorem is concluding. Okay, so that's how you get there. Maybe a comment or two about this. So, you know, one reason I think this theorem is interesting in the context of quantum gravity and the SCFT is that, okay, it relates entanglement on one hand to causal features of the geometry. And then this Ryu-Taganaki formula I was talking about earlier relates entanglement and space-like surfaces, okay? And so through these two connections, you can just end up with a geometric statement relating causal features of ADS spacetimes to minimal surfaces in ADS spacetimes. So you can think about it just as a statement in general relativity. And indeed, actually with Jeff and John, we were able to just use techniques from general relativity to offer a sort of independent proof of this theorem. So it's sort of nice that you get these two very different ways to understand this. Okay, so that's everything I was going to say about this theorem. Are there any questions at this point? Okay. Okay. So the last part is I wanted to tell you about what I think this sort of reasoning tells us about quantum information theory, or at least about a particular topic in information theory called non-local quantum computation. Okay. So to motivate this, I want to recall what's called position-based cryptography. So many of you may have heard of this before, but let me remind you. So in position-based cryptography, Bob is going to try and verify Alice's location in space-time. Okay. So he's going to they're going to agree on some space-time region R, and then Bob's going to try and check that Alice is inside of R. Okay, the way he's going to do this is by setting up one of these quantum tasks, asking Alice to complete it, and trying to choose a task that Alice is forced to do by acting inside of R. Okay, In particular, he's going to ask Alice to implement some channel, which he hopes she'll only be able to do in this local way. And then just because of the geometry, if you do it locally, you're forced to act inside of R. Okay. On the other hand, if Alice is going to cheat, the way she can do that is to use the non-local strategy here, right? Because that lets her act only outside of the region R. Okay. So that's the sort of tension here, is Bob's going to try and choose some very challenging channel, and then Alice is going to try and instead implement that non-locally. Okay. So the first question to ask about this is, you know, can Alice cheat, or is there a secure method here? And the answer is yes, Alice can always cheat. But the key thing is that she will need entanglement here, you know, as was the case for this B84 task, but also, you know, in general, she'll need entanglement. Okay, indeed, she can always cheat. But then we can ask a little bit of a more refined question of, if I say specify that Bob's going to input n qubits here, how does the number of EPR pairs you need, L, scale with n? Okay. If the scaling is really bad, right, if L is exponential in n, then we could argue that, you know, this is secure in a practical sense, in that for reasonable sizes of n, we don't think Alice will be able to store enough EPR pairs. And so effectively this becomes secure. So this motivates understanding exactly what the scaling is here, or the best case, the best Alice can do there. Okay. So people have worked on this, and I will tell you a little bit about the most efficient known protocols for doing this. Okay. So the most efficient known protocol makes use of what's called port teleportation. And people may be familiar with this. There's been a few papers coming out about it recently. But let me sketch out the way it works. So what happens is we're going to teleport some quantum system A, and we will measure A. In order to teleport it, we're going to measure A jointly with one end of L EPR pairs here. Okay. So we do some big measurement on all those systems. We get out some outcome J. Now, what these authors showed is that if you choose this measurement correctly, you can arrange such that after the measurement, the system A is reproduced on one of these other ends of the EPR pairs. So on subsystem BJ, it just reappears on BJ, at least approximately. Okay. And then the closeness of the approximation they found is controlled by this number here. So there's a exponential in n, where n is the number of qubits in A, and then just a 1 over L here, 1 over square root L. Okay, so that means that for a good approximation here, L will need to be like 2 to the n. Okay, so you need lots of entanglement to do this. So this teleportation, you know, I think is interesting for a number of reasons. One is just that I think it's sort of fascinating that you can define a teleportation where the correction operation on the other end, you know, as opposed to say applying some poly, is instead just to trace out all these unwanted subsystems, right? That's very interesting because the trace commutes with applying some operators or some channels. And so, you know, what's convenient about this is that before you know J, you could do some unitary to A by just doing U tensor producted across all of the EPR pairs.
Sorry, a quick question.
Yeah, Debbie, hi.
Is that 2 to the 4n for L to get a good approximation? I'm slightly confused.
Oh, are you saying I wrote this number wrong?
I quickly just took the square root of L and tried to get a small number.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I, Yeah, I just meant exponential. Not, I wasn't.
Thank you. Good.
You're correct.
Thanks.
Sorry, I was just being schematic, but you're right. Okay, yes. So the fact that this you can apply unitaries here to your output B before you know J is sort of very interesting, and it means that this is connected to a number of other interesting topics in quantum information theory. For instance, universal processors and transversality in quantum error correcting codes. So it's sort of quite an interesting protocol. But okay, the interest in it here is that this is sort of the key and most expensive step in the most efficient known non-local computation protocols. So those were found by these authors, and they found a scaling of L like n to the 2 to the n. Okay. So you have this exponential cost. There's also a factor associated with epsilon, which is the closeness with which you've reproduced the local channel non-locally. Okay, so that's just an epsilon that appears here. So that's the best known construction. And then just a comment is that for Clifford operations, so if I took U to be some Clifford unitary, then this port teleportation idea is not necessary. And you can just get away with using regular teleportation, and that lets you use a only a linear amount of entanglement. Okay, good. So now I want to compare this sort of best construction in quantum information theory to what ADS-CFT seems to be doing. Okay, so let's think again about this setup where I have this task embedded into ADS space. I'll input n qubits here and have some channel n happen in the bulk. Okay, now I'm interested in how many qubits I can put in and how much entanglement I have, right? For the number of qubits, you can argue that so long as you take n to be small enough that you don't change your geometry, right? You don't back react, then you should be okay and you should be able to do this channel, right? And the back reaction is controlled by Einstein's equation, right? Which couples matter, in this case our qubits, to geometry with a factor of G Newton. And so that means that I can take n to be order 1 over G Newton before I start getting this back reaction. Okay, so n is order 1 over G Newton. But then I talked in some detail earlier in the talk about how the mutual information at most is itself order 1 over G Newton, right? And so that means, you know, just comparing these, that I have apparently a linear scaling of entanglement with the number of qubits here. Okay, so this suggests that ADS-CFT is itself some more efficient method for doing non-local computation. And you know, I think something interesting to do moving forward and something I'm thinking about is to try and, you know, use ideas or tools from ADS-CFT to actually go and construct, you know, explicit quantum information protocols for doing this. And, you know, hopefully that tells us something new about non-local computation. And, you know, as I pointed out, aspects of non-local computation connect to other areas in information theory, like in this port teleportation was connected to, say, transverse codes. And, you know, we could hope that maybe we'll get some insight into those subjects as well. So this is ongoing work. Kefir has been thinking about this. Patrick has been thinking about this. I've been thinking about this. But there's no definite conclusions there yet. Okay. So just to qualify that statement a little bit, what this is really telling me is that any channel I can do in this bulk scattering region is one that I can do with linear entanglement in the boundary. And I should, you know, be explicit in saying that we don't understand exactly which channels those are, right? So people have thought, for instance, that perhaps in the context of gravity, the complexity of operations you're able to do are limited. People argue, for instance, that, you know, each gate requires some energy, and if you do too many gates, then you end up with a black hole and you can't do this. So that may come into this story as well. So, you know, the more precise statement is, anything I can do in this space-time region in the context of gravity is something I can do with linear entanglement non-locally. So yeah, we don't exactly understand what that class is, but I think it's clear that it's at least more than the Clifford group, which is what we currently understand can be done linearly from the quantum information side. Okay. So that is everything I wanted to say today. Am I on time? It's about right. Okay. So I'll just summarize briefly here. So the first point I wanted to make was that these quantum tasks capture sort of space-time specific aspects of quantum information. And then that this perspective on quantum information seems to be relevant to quantum gravity. In particular, it leads to this connected wedge theorem. And I would argue that I think this motivates further understanding these relativistic quantum tasks just from the perspective of information theory. They seem to have a nice application, and so, you know, maybe we should understand those better. Okay, and then, you know, finally, I was arguing that ADS-CFT seems to give us some new insights into quantum tasks, or at least into this non-local computation idea. And, you know, perhaps it will end up connecting to broader ideas in information theory as well. Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Alex. It was a really nice talk. Do we have further questions for him? I have a quick one. So I found the last part very interesting, and I was wondering if that insight from ADS-CFT may also lead to new teleportation protocols.
Yeah, I mean, that could be something interesting, right? Like, I think it feels like we'll need to know something new about quantum information theory in order to construct these more efficient protocols, and what form exactly that's going to take, I don't know. I mean, one thing that we're thinking about is, I think I added a slide about this, here. So there is a really interesting role for quantum error correction in ADS-CFT, in that ADS-CFT defines a subsystem error correcting code. So if I take a time slice of my ADS space, if I have some qubit sitting in this region, which is defined by looking at these minimal surfaces that appear in the Ryu-Taganaki formula, then those qubits are the ones that are stored in this boundary region here, A. So another way to say that would be that, you know, some operator acting on A can be, so this is a logical operator acting on qubit A, can be written as some operator on the, like, physical degrees of freedom labeled by capital A. So this is, you know, I think one of the key structures at play in ADS-CFT and, you know, may come into the construction of these more efficient protocols. And so, it may be that there's some interesting insight into this kind of a code, or a way that this code can be exploited for doing these non-local computations. I think everything I can say there is still a bit speculative, because we don't know how it's going to shake out exactly.
Yeah. Thanks. Any further questions for Alex?
We have a raised hand from Robert.
Oh yeah, please just go ahead and ask.
Hi. It was a very interesting talk. What I didn't quite get a sense of is it how much does this care about what's in the bulk? I mean, if there's the black hole or if there's some other structure, it looks, or is this just all empty ADS?
Oh yes. So the statement is just true, not just for empty ADS, but for any space-time that satisfies the null energy condition. So the argument from this quantum tasks perspective just cares about where these light rays reach, right? And so if you have a black hole or something, but you know, you can still, but you find that the scattering region is not empty, then the argument still applies, and this statement about the mutual information should be true. And then when you go and prove this using general relativity, the assumption is just that the null energy condition on the bulk stress tensor is true. And so any spacetime that has that satisfies that will have this theorem be true.
Okay, thank you.
Chat.
Okay. All right. So if for the moment, if there are no further questions, we can end. Debbie, you have one? No. Okay. Sorry. We can end the official part of the talk and thank Alex again for a very nice talk. And everyone for attending, and I guess we'll see each other next year in official functioning.